is Conversations in Healthcare. I'm Mark Masella.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, you can feel the anticipation in the air as we count down towards the Health Summit, which is less than 24 hours away. The main event will take place at the White House. The president has posted his proposal. It really attempts to grab ideas from both sides of the aisle, clearly trying to engage Republicans to be part of the process. But I'm not sure he's going to be successful. As the Republican leadership has said, this process needs to start over. And they know if they compromise, even on a dramatically reduced bill, they will have to embrace ideas that ideologues on their side will be dead set against.
Mark, we seem to find ourselves in a real deadlock, and it appears that the 2012 elections are in full swing. And while that might make political hay now, I just can't see that this is good for the country. The gridlock is affecting everything in Washington, and it's the reason that so many politicians are seeking to retire, some from very safe seats. We saw this last week when Indiana Senator Evan Bayh let it be known that he was not going to seek re-election, and he had a stinging rebuke to Congress. Bayh's a moderate, and he said, "For some time I've had a growing conviction Congress is not operating as it should. There's too much partisanship, not enough progress. Too much narrow ideology, not enough practical problem solving. Even at a time of enormous challenge, the people's business is not being done."
The president is trying to recalibrate his message to the American people. In his weekly radio broadcast, he took the insurance companies to the woodshed for their stunning increases that were proposed by Anthem Blue Cross of California. He reminded us that we do nothing, it might be good for the insurance companies, but bad for America. Last year, they made $12 billion in profits, and yet they're asking for increases that would make health insurance unaffordable to many working Americans.
Mark, that increase up to 39% was jaw-dropping. And the president wants to bring the focus of the broader conversation back to the impact rising health care costs are having on the economy. He singled out the plight that small businesses are finding themselves in with these premium increases. They're unable to buy insurance, and then they're unable to compete. And these are the engines for job growth in our country. That's why President Obama proposed on Monday giving the federal government new power to block excessive rate increases by the health insurance companies.
The president wants Democrats and Republicans to come tomorrow in a spirit of good faith to seek common ground. He's noted that he supported many Republican ideas on health reform, like letting people buy insurance from companies across state line, as well as giving small businesses the ability to pool together to help reduce premium costs. He wants to know what Democratic proposals they are supportive of. But he won't agree to their demand to scrap the entire process and start over. And he's pushing them to let the American people know what they believe in, not what only they oppose.
And there seems to be some evidence that most Americans do agree we need to move forward. The latest Washington Post ABC poll last week found the majority of Americans do not think the country should give up on negotiating a health care bill this year.
Past the issues of health reform, there's lots of creative thinking and writing in the area of innovations. Dr. Peter Pronovost, our guest back in December, came out with a new book called Safe Patients, Smart Hospitals, How One Doctor's Checklist Can Help Us Change Healthcare from the Inside Out. He talked with us about a simple hospital checklist being adopted worldwide to save more lives and reduce cost. Dr. Pronovost, an anesthesiologist and critical care specialist at Johns Hopkins, composed his first checklist to avoid infections when putting in central lines. The results were shocking. After just 1 year, the 10-day line infection rate went down from 11% to zero. In just one hospital, the checklist has prevented 43 infections and 8 deaths and saved $2 million in cost.
Those are compelling numbers. And for those of you who've read Dr. Atul Gawande's The Checklist Manifesto, you know exactly how much he advocates for this simple measure. Dr. Gawande, who is a surgeon, not only tells the story of how an emergency checklist saved a drowning girl in Austria against all odds, but he also talks about how flying airplanes and building skyscrapers also strongly adhere to checklists for safety.
Speaking of books, our guest today is Thomas Goetz, executive editor of Wired Magazine and author of the newly released book, The Decision Tree, Taking Control of Your Health in the New Era of Personalized Medicine. Goetz proposes a new strategy for thinking about health and looks at the innovations in predictive medicine.
No matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. You can now subscribe to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded, or if you'd like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have feedback, we'd love to hear from you. But first, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. President Obama has unveiled his proposal to be discussed at tomorrow's bipartisan summit on health care. The plan includes many of the ideas from the Democratic House and Senate bills, but is clearly the president's stance on what reform should look like. Republicans are preparing to bring their own ideas to the meeting, and the White House said last week they will incorporate some of them into the Democratic proposal. Still, Democrats made it clear they are not going to scratch the bill and start over, a demand Republicans have made in the weeks leading up to the summit. President Obama said he wants Republican and Democratic lawmakers to move forward together when they meet on Thursday in one last effort to reform health care.
It's our chance to finally give Americans the peace of mind of knowing that they'll be able to have affordable coverage when they need it most.
Republicans will be there tomorrow, ready to participate, but they are not happy about the new bill or how negotiations have been laid out. House Minority Leader John Boehner said that Mr. Obama has, quote, crippled the credibility for Thursday by proposing the same massive government takeover of health care. The new proposal includes a health insurance rate authority that will regulate unreasonable increases by insurance companies, as seen last week when Anthem Blue Cross proposed rate hikes on individual plans of up to 39%. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said it just makes sense to allow the federal government to do what many states already do to control health insurance rates.
I don't think anybody would consider what a state insurance commissioner would do to be regulating the increases largely unjustifiable for health insurance to be an intrusion in their lives, but in fact a help.
The proposal sticks largely to the president's goal to expand coverage, prevent insurers from discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions, and of course, to control rising health care spending. The new plan would cost $950 billion over the next 10 years. That's an additional $75 billion more than the Senate bill. A mix of Medicare cuts, tax increases, and new fees on health care industries would help finance the new bill. White House Health Reform Chief Nancy Ann DeParle said the proposal also contains some key improvements. One removes the special Medicaid deal the Senate gave to Nebraska, and another helps states absorb the cost of Medicaid expansion when it begins in 2014 and continues through 2017.
The president's proposal eliminates the Nebraska FMAP provision and provides significant additional federal financing to all states for the expansion of Medicaid.
If no Republicans are willing to go along with Democrats to approve fixes to the Senate bill, the Democrats will have no choice but to use budget reconciliation to pass the bill. That procedure only requires a simple majority vote in each House. This week, we're exploring personalized medicine. As we've been discussing on Conversations, the healthcare industry is undergoing some major changes, and it's not just the ideas being debated in Congress. Technological advances in healthcare are here, and many involve giving patients better access to their health information. The Brooklyn Health Information Exchange has been working to do just that as a consortium of hospitals, nursing homes, home health providers, and insurers. The not-for-profit group is seeking to add some functionality to their system so that patients can use all the available technology to manage their own care and get the feedback they need. Executive Director of BHICS, Irene Koch, said the concept is just beginning to take off.
They are already able to get access to their own health information and to answer questions that will be leading them through some other, you know, sort of a tree of different relevant questions to give them recommendations on some of the things they might want to follow up on.
Koch likes the idea of transparency for patients so that they can become more involved in their health.
I think that patients will be able to get real information about their care through kind of apps we'll be able to deliver through the exchange that will take their data as it becomes increasingly standardized and be able to analyze it and do things that really up till now we haven't really been able to imagine in healthcare because the data has been so siloed.
But people seeking to understand their health is nothing new. Patient groups and medical information have been around ever since the internet became available as a place to exchange ideas. The challenge now for the healthcare industry is to create a safe platform for this dialogue. DJ Edgerton's company, Zemoga, helped develop a service called Pixels and Pills. It's an online space that helps patients know more about the drugs they are taking. Although individuals are using social networks more frequently to discuss and learn about health, Edgerton said there's not a lot of qualified information out there.
If you use Facebook, for an example, you know, a lot of pharmaceutical companies do not activate the wall posting functionality because of the bear of a responsibility it is to moderate the conversation, to make sure that they react accordingly to adverse events, and we're building applications that allow that to happen in a more efficient way.
We'll continue to keep our listeners informed with more developments in personalized medicine. For now, let's listen to the interview with Thomas Goetz.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Thomas Goetz, author of the newly released book, The Decision Tree, Taking Control of Your Health in the New Era of Personalized Medicine. Thomas Goetz, welcome. You've been a journalist for 15 years from the Village Voice to your current position as executive editor at Wired Magazine. Along the way, you decided to pursue a degree in public health. You said that it was the discipline of public health, its deference to data and focus on the big picture of populations that you found most fascinating. Out of that combination of interest came an insight that there was a huge disconnect between the public health world and the technology world. Tell us about that disconnect. Is it less now? And if so, who or what is making that happen?
Well, I think it's changing. I think my day job at Wired Magazine is kind of all about the power of technology to change people's lives. But that's built kind of on the increasing availability and democratization of technologies. But in the public health world, you know, the scope is so large that there's often been a kind of suspicion of technology as being something that doesn't really scale to large numbers of people. And in many ways, that's because in medicine, technology is kind of paradoxically something that raises costs. I mean, a lot of the reasons that our healthcare system is so expensive is that we're on this kind of technology race, and there are expensive technologies that don't really kind of follow the rules that they do in the consumer technology world. So that was kind of a contradiction that I think is changing now, because I think the fact is that consumer technologies are starting to make inroads in healthcare.
Thomas, you use three simple but powerful words in your book: predict, prevent, and detect. Now, I think most Americans have at least a passing familiarity with the concepts of prevention and early detection. Whether we practice prevention, get exercise and diet and vaccines is another story, but generally people know what they should do. And the same with early detection, which is why pap smears and mammograms have been so well accepted. But predict, that's still relatively new. You've focused on the power of personal genetics and the power of using data to predict the likelihood and risk of certain health problems. Tell us about the state of the science and the art of one's predicting their health future, and maybe who's driving it, consumers, business, or the healthcare community?
So a lot of what we think about in terms of our health risks, you go to the doctor, they are concerned about your cholesterol count. That's a risk for heart disease that is basically a statistic. So prediction is already kind of what is built into our system, but the fact is that people are now starting to use it much more prominently as a lever, and using stuff like genetics as a way to even get earlier in the process. So you don't have to wait for your cholesterol count to start getting high. You can see if you are predisposed genetically to perhaps having a higher risk for heart disease. So it's a great opportunity for insight. It doesn't answer the whole picture. I mean, you know, our genetics kind of spit us out into the world, but then everything we start to do from day one is really a huge driver and will always be a huge driver in kind of what happens to us. So I think the fact that these genetic tools are getting cheaper and more available to more people is an opportunity for us to get more insight into who we are and how we can be mindful of our health. I don't think it's the answer, certainly not everything that we need to know about our health.
Speaking about reaching back, you reach back into antiquity to recall that Aristotle struggled with the same question we do every day, the disconnect between our intentions and our actions, what Aristotle called akrasia, a lack of self-control, or we know what we should and should not do, but we fail to do the right thing for our health much of the time. But scientists haven't figured out that mystery of why over the past 2,300 years, but you suggest there might be new hope for motivating us to get over that disconnect. What's the state of the research in this area, and would Aristotle find some hope in it?
So this idea that, you know, we know what we're supposed to do, but we don't do it, has always been kind of has plagued mankind for, as you say, for thousands of years. The opportunity now is really to take that observation that we're irrational one step further and to say that, okay, we do kind of make decisions for other reasons, but we still have this rational component. So how do we deliver information? How do we deliver health information in a way that resonates with us emotionally or personally, so that we can kind of process through our irrational selves and get us to do things that our rational selves know we should do? And that, I think, is the opportunity that I try to explore in the book, the opportunity to give people information that really resonates with them and isn't just some abstract notion that they're able to easily dismiss, but something that really makes them confront their own role in their health and not only makes them realize that, but makes them feel empowered by that.
And Thomas, you mentioned in the book that technology companies like Microsoft and healthcare systems like Kaiser Permanente have made major investments into this personalized, technology-based healthcare. Certainly both of these companies are known for their innovations and for getting results, one focused on selling products, the other on prevention and treatment. What's the synergy here? And can you give our listeners some examples of how a system like Kaiser uses the technology of a company like Microsoft?
The opportunity here really comes down to one of data. We're entering this age of what we call at Wired big data. It's it's unfathomable amounts of information. And when you look at something like Kaiser, they've got 9 million members in that healthcare system, and they were one of the first health maintenance organizations to go into a electronic record system. So they have years of information all collected electronically, so that's all data. And they can crunch that and process that to understand how should people be making better decisions. They have a system that they've developed in this clinic in Hawaii that they're going to be rolling out nationally. It spots when somebody has some indicators on their medical record that they're at a higher risk for something, say they need a colonoscopy or something, but they're not necessarily being scheduled for that procedure or being scheduled for that test. And they're able to use the data to flag that need and send an alert out to the patient and to the physician to get them into the clinic before something goes wrong. And Microsoft is doing similar things. You know, they're not working with Kaiser directly necessarily, but they're understanding their own data.
We're speaking today with Thomas Goetz, executive editor at Wired Magazine and author of The Decision Tree, Taking Control of Your Health in the New Era of Personalized Medicine. Thomas, what kinds of online health tracking systems are out there for ordinary people? Might there be an app out there for our listeners to help them out?
So that's one of the really neat things. When I started writing the book 2 years ago or so, there were a couple little things here or there, but right now there's almost a tool for every need. It's happened very quickly. So if you go to something like the iPhone App Store for your iPhone, there are literally thousands of tracking tools that help people lose weight, that help diabetics track their blood glucose level, that help people exercise more. There's also a kind of model health community online called Patients Like Me, which has thousands of people that have joined together around various diseases, joining the community, adding their data, getting collaborative insights, not just stories, but sharing real information.
And that has turned out, I think, to be a very powerful tool that we all recognize. But, you know, there's a term out there that we've also heard, cyberchondria. Basically, people being overly concerned with symptoms based on what they've read online. And certainly today, anybody can, and patients more often than not now do, get health information online, often researching their symptoms before they see the doctor and going home and researching the diagnosis afterwards. And this is only 9 years after the AMA warned people that using the internet to self-diagnose may be putting their lives at risk. It seems like the best path would be for providers and patients to work together to use the power of the internet for education and support and guidance. Do you see this happening? Are there models of that that you've seen in the course of your research?
The internet is a wonderful tool, and it's kind of unprecedented in history, the amount of information that's available. The trick is, what filters should we use and can we use to process that information? And right now, it's all very raw, and people go out there, you know, researching a headache, and they end up looking at brain tumors. You know, odds are, dollars to donuts, if you have a headache, you probably don't have a brain tumor. So the trick is, how do we get the information to people that is specific to them, that is relevant to them, that is meaningful to them? And that is being worked on. There's this great project out of Harvard called, it's a website called lifemath.net. And it's some very basic calculators and tools where you can enter a few simple metrics, your age, your blood pressure, things like that, and it gives you specific information, specific recommendations for what you might want to look out for. And that those kind of tools, you know, we need more of them.
You postulated in your Huffington Post piece that you needed to have a healthcare crisis before there could be an effective behavior change. Do we actually need to be afraid before we start caring about our health? And how are those who are facing serious health problems using personalized technology after such an event?
What I was trying to get at in that piece, and it's a theme that I draw on much larger in the book, is this idea that when people do have a health crisis, when they have something go wrong, it's a wake-up call. And so what exactly is being catalyzed? What is that moment where we have this scare and it catapults us into new action? What I was trying to get at was, how do we actually take advantage of that impulse without the negative side, right? And so that's what I was hoping that you know, these new tools can provide a wake-up call, but without the scare to go along with it.
Thomas, when you look around the country and the world, and we know you have a very broad perspective, what do you see now that excites you in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
What I'm most excited about is the fact that individuals are excited about this stuff. You know, there's a movement that started, a kind of patient participation movement, where people want their records, people want to get their information, and they want to be participants in the decision making for their medical care. They don't want to be making all the decisions, but they want to be involved. And I think that's an incredibly hopeful gesture, because some of the research that I turned up showed that when people do get involved in their healthcare, when they take a role and when they participate, in general, they tend to have better outcomes. It's good for us to start making decisions. It's good for us to feel like we have a role. So I think, you know, taking advantage of the places where we can do that, you know, whether it's getting our iPhone and loading it up with apps if we're that kind of person and we really want to kind of geek out on all the metrics, that's one way to do it. Whether it's making sure that our doctor explains things to us 2 and 3 times over until we really understand what he's saying, and that's something I have to do myself. You know, they talk so fast and they tell you so many things all at once that asking them to slow down is a really important step. So I think it's those measures, and it's the fact that is catching on as something that people know that they have a right to do and a responsibility to do. To me, that makes me very hopeful.
Today, we've been speaking with Thomas Goetz, author of the newly released book, The Decision Tree, Taking Control of Your Health in the New Era of Personalized Medicine. Thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Thomas.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea takes a look abroad at the smart card that has made France's healthcare system one of the most effective in the world. Nearly all of France's 61 million citizens carry what is known as the La Carte Vitale, a small green card that holds their medical records, insurance information, and prescriptions. La Carte Vitale streamlines the ordinary, complicated process of piecing together patients' medical histories by compiling all of their files in one place. Most European and Asian countries with nationalized healthcare systems have been using similar smart cards since the late 1990s and have seen their efficiencies rise while costs fall. France began using La Carte Vitale in 1998 and now has 60% fewer administrative staff. If the United States were to use a smart card system, the benefits would be twofold. First, it would aid hospitals in their efforts to reduce expenses and improve quality by consolidating patient records and increasing portability. No longer would patients waste time and paper filling out the same forms every time they go to a new doctor or hospital. And secondly, smart cards would ease many Americans' fears about other people illegally using their insurance information to obtain care. Currently, about 500,000 Americans have suffered medical identity theft, but the smart card's PIN requirements would help eliminate such problems. Overall, smart cards simplify the administrative complexity of identifying and tracking patients and delivering consistent care over time. Now, the only missing link is uniting these systems so that patient cards work everywhere around the country. These smart cards might be small, but they certainly carry a lot of weight. Now, that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health.